This is a previously recorded episode.
This show is broadcasting live from Detroit Sound Studios above Activate Gaming and is part of the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
Welcome to MI Tech Cast, a live internet radio show offering the latest news and interviews with the people driving business, technology, and politics in Michigan. MI Tech Cast is an affiliate of the Podcast Detroit Network. Now, your hosts, Matt Rausch and Mike Brennan.
This is Mike Brennan, editor and publisher of MITechNews.com, and I'm in the studio with my former competitor and now my ally, how the world is changing, Matt Rausch, formerly of WWJ, now Engineering Society of Detroit.
Well, and we were always pretty friendly competitors anyway, so.
That's true. We go back to when I was at the Free Press and he was at Crane's, and it's been going on for 20 years, I guess.
Yes, and we've been covering, we've been covering the tech economy here in Michigan.
Well, anyway, that didn't work out.
Well, we're on the air and we've already had our first technical malfunction. This is cool. All right, that's all right. Okay. Well, that we don't have to wonder when that's going to happen now.
No. Got that out of the way. There was some music, and we had Foster Brown doing the intro. But tune in next week. We'll get it working, I hope.
Right? And it may work during the program breaks here today. Hi, this is Matt Rausch.
And Mike Brennan. I almost forgot my cue there. So.
Okay. And we're here with the latest addition to the Podcast Detroit family, the M Squared TechCast. You will notice when you hear the music that it had a different name, but we've already changed the name to the M Squared TechCast. We're going to talk about technology from a Michigan perspective, from a Midwestern perspective, and we've got a great show lined up for you today for our first show. And the first thing we'd like to do, I guess, Mike, is talk about this week in technology with the big tech headlines. So why don't you start us off?
Well, this week coming up, or actually in 2 weeks coming up, is the Digital Detroit Summit, and a two-day event that's going to be going on at the Max Fisher Music Center in Detroit on the September 22nd and 23rd. And if you're into digital marketing, this is going to be the place to be. There's going to be a lot of experts from a lot of very big companies who are going to tell you how to work your magic, and gosh knows, we all need to have more magic in our digital lives, right, Matt?
Absolutely. And I was just curious, Digital Detroit was a name that was big around here in the late 90s, early aughts. Is this the same group of people? Is this the Sloan Brothers, or is this somebody else now?
This is somebody else. No, that was Digital Detroit. This is the Digital Summit Detroit.
Ah, okay.
So I don't think Jeff or... Jeff, Richard, what Richard, was his brother's
Richard,
name?
Richard, yes. Richard, yes.
Thank you. I don't think they're involved in this, but it's a big conference. More details at MITechNews.com. And Matt, why don't you throw in one of your headlines?
All right. Michigan Technological University, one of Michigan's real hidden gems. It's way the heck up north in the Upper Peninsula, about as far north in Michigan and really in the whole United States as you can go without either getting wet or going Canadian. It's way up there. It happens to be farther away from Detroit than Washington, D.C. is. But fall enrollment at Michigan Tech is the highest the school has seen in more than 30 years. It's more than 7,200 students. And interestingly, enrollment of women is at a record high, with women now making up 27% of the student body. Back a million years ago when I was in college, women were only about 10% of the student body at Michigan Tech. So what you're seeing here is more evidence of girls going tech. Female enrollment in the Michigan Tech College of Engineering is up to 27% as well, and the number of women first-year students is at an all-time high. That's good to see, because there is a real engineering and tech job shortage here in Michigan, and we kind of need all hands on deck.
And I know there's a lot of folks that are trying to get more women into the STEAM, STEM, they call it different things, science, technology, engineering, arts, and math is the new buzz.
Yep.
So that's good. And actually, it's not just happening at Michigan Tech. Seems that engineering enrollment for women is going up around the state. So they're attracted to these jobs. And that's a good thing. I think we need some more diversity out there.
And it's interesting that Michigan Tech saw the women's enrollment going up. They still struggle in some of the traditional male-dominated fields like mechanical engineering. But since they added stuff like biomedical engineering, you're seeing a lot of a lot more women being interested in that. It's a healthcare-related field, and enrollment women's enrollment in that field is just about 50-50, which is great to see.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you're a maker out there, what's a maker? Well, gosh, you know, you're on a CNC machine. You're building something with your hands. Kind of going back to the hallmark of Detroit when we were a big tool and die shop 110-20 years ago in Detroit. That's why the auto industry came here. So anyway, America's Greatest Makers is coming to television in 2016. And if you're a maker and you've got a really good idea, there's this collaboration going on with United Artists and Turner Broadcasting, but the big thing is the grand prize is $1 million.
$1 million.
That's a lot of cheese.
Yes.
So if you're a maker, you want to check that out. More details at mitechnews.com. I would encourage you to do so. The deadline on that is early October to submit your entry.
Okay. Another rather self-referential headline, of course, is that we have the debut of the M2 TechCast, which is right now today. This TechCast, this podcast, is going to be online most Mondays. I would imagine we'll take a holiday or two off here and there, but it's going to be on most Mondays at 3 p.m., and you'll be able to eventually you'll be able to call in and discuss the issues of the day with us, and we're really looking forward to this.
And we just discovered today that we can actually take multiple calls. We weren't sure about that since this is the first show, and we're kind of learning the technology here. So, but that's good. So we can have a lot of folks calling in, asking questions of our guests, and then more importantly, audio podcast will be available after the show for those that want to listen on demand. At you know, whenever on the airplane, in the car, wherever they're at.
Okay. Also, we wanted to talk a little bit about a Department of State computer outage. Mike, you covered that one for us.
Yeah, they've had some issues there with the mainframe, and this is the second outage in the past week to hit the Department of State. Now, it wasn't a real major outage in the sense it didn't last all day, but it still lasted a half an hour and annoyed a few people who were standing in line, which are already standing in line at the Department of State office, which is annoying enough, but when you can't do anything once you get to the window, not so good. So they're continuing to struggle with that, and hopefully we'll get all that fixed. But there's a lot of upgrades going on with the state computer system, and you know you got to expect these things to happen, right?
Yeah, once in a while, absolutely. But did that mean you couldn't do stuff that you would normally be able to do, conduct business with the Department of State? Like I haven't been into a Secretary of State's office in years because you can get your tabs online now. You can do just about everything you need to do with them online.
Yeah, well,
right?
For half an hour you couldn't do anything.
Okay,
it was down. And they scrambled around. We'll have to get some of those folks on the show one of these days to talk about some of these issues.
Okay. Another thing I wanted to mention, as most of you know, or many of you know who are listening here, I am Director of Communications at the Engineering Society of Detroit, which is a great professional organization. Essentially, I call it a great club for nerds and geeks. It is for engineers, scientists, people in related technical fields. We cover the waterfront from the construction trades to IT. One of the things we also do is run events for other people. We're going to be talking about cybersecurity here in a few minutes, but I also wanted to mention another upcoming event. October 25th and 26th at Cobo Center in Detroit is the Governor's 2015 North American International Cyber Summit that ESD is running for the state of Michigan. We're going to be having some fun talking about cybersecurity here in a little while, but I wanted to mention that event that's coming up. And we've got a tremendous agenda. We've got some military people. We've got some private sector people. We've got university academics all talking about cybersecurity, how to keep your stuff safe, perhaps more importantly to most of us, how to keep our infrastructure safe.
Yeah,
that's the really scary part of all this, I think.
And Richard Seenan, who's sitting in studio with me, the author of There Will Be Cyber War, and Dan Lorman, who's calling in, the former state chief information security
chief
officer.
Chief security officer.
Chief security officer. Thank you, Richard. We'll be discussing that here in about another 5 minutes or so, but there's a lot of big issues out there if you got a business or just protect your home. Bad guys are trying to get in online.
Yes. Indeed they are. And that's one of the things I like to say is that the Internet of Things is the Internet of Things that can be compromised and the Internet of Things that can be hacked from your stove to your refrigerator to everything else in your life. I mean, if we're really connecting all this stuff now, that makes it at least somewhat vulnerable to mischief.
Yeah, absolutely. We also have in the studio with us Dave Weaver, the quiet one there from Great Lakes Angels. He'll be talking about what's going on in angel investing. That'll be in the third segment. And in the fourth segment, Matt has a guest. Why don't you introduce him?
Oh, yes. Well, we have someone from our sort of video game community and also someone from the State Film Office, which has sort of renamed itself, what do they call it now, the State Film and
Digital Media Office.
They no longer have money to give away, but they say they have other support to give to video production and film production and also video game and computer game production in the state. The state, in its wisdom, recently ended its credit program for those endeavors.
Yeah.
So we'll be asking a couple of people in that industry, hopefully one in studio, one calling in, from a couple of companies here in Detroit that are involved in that business, Vectorform and Pixofactor, about how that's affected them and how they see the industry evolving here in Michigan.
And also, the Film Office / Digital Media Office is one of the big sponsors for the Digital Marketing Summit here in on the 22nd and 23rd, so that's how they are spending some of their money.
All right. Okay, well, it's about 12 past the hour at this point. I think we're going to take a break for a couple of minutes, and we'll come back and talk.
About 3:15, we're going to talk cybersecurity with Richard Steenan and hopefully Dan Lorman if he calls in out there. But this is the first show, so everything is happening interestingly.
Yes, everything's happening at once.
Yes. All right, we'll be back.
Shout to the heart!
This is a previously recorded episode.
All right, well, we're back, and we're back with our cybersecurity section. Transitions are a little rocky today, but hey, we'll get this down, right, Matt? So,
who needs fade?
Yeah,
come on,
yeah,
we'll just come in, we'll go out,
yeah,
it's all right.
Yeah. This is Mike Grennan with
Matt Rausch,
and we're here at the Podcast Detroit Studios on our first day, as you can probably tell.
The palatial, wonderful Podcast Detroit Studios.
Yes. And we have in the studio with us, we have Richard Steenan, the author of There Will Be Cyber War. I have to do that. I'm sorry. And then on the line, hopefully you're there, right, Dan?
I am here, yeah.
Dan Lorman with Security Mentor, who's the former chief security officer of the state of Michigan until about this time last year, wasn't it? Something like that, Dan?
Yeah, it was last August. Yep.
Okay, good. Hey, what I want you guys, Richard and you, to talk about, you can do it however you want. We'll just sort of referee it here. But, I mean, I want to look at what are some of the really current issues that anybody in business should be aware of in terms of the cybersecurity threats out there?
Well, unfortunately, everybody in business is well aware of them because they're experiencing the direct impact from the hacking against their own networks. And if they're treating it as if these are just news items, what we hear about Sony, what we hear about Target, Home Depot, and most recently the Office of Personnel Management, or Ashley Madison, I mean, you just can't go a week without a major story of some crazy breach. If you're in business and you're still thinking those are about something else that you don't have to pay attention to, then it's probably time to ask somebody to take a look at your own network because you're probably in the process of being breached today.
Absolutely. I agree with that. No doubt. And there's so many examples of that, Richard, whether it be ransomware or phishing to get credentials. There's just literally a long list we can go through.
Yeah, those phishing emails that you get are a constant reminder. You know, they might not be working against you because you're so smart, but there are people that they're working against. Otherwise, the phishers wouldn't keep sending out those crazy, you know, emails from wherever saying that you want all this money or, you know, please let me in and get access to your bank account because I have to change something. And we see these every single day. They must be working.
Absolutely. But I think one thing people may not know that is that the first thing that often the first line of attack for all hackers is you know what's the easiest way in. If they can trick you into clicking on a link or giving up your password, any type of fraud, almost all of the biggest hacks that have happened in the last couple of years started with them getting the credentials of a system administrator or somebody who was authorized to have access to the database. Reports around Sony and even the OPM hack in Washington, if they can get those credentials, maybe there's other types of attacks they want to do once they get inside, but that's one way to bypass defenses.
Well, the thing I'd like to ask both of you is, for in terms of business, that's one thing. But I'm also interested in hacks of infrastructure, sort of public sector stuff. So, what of that kind? What attacks of that type really keep you up at night? I mean, we haven't seen those attacks on a large scale yet. So, what I also want to know is, are we lucky or are we good, or maybe it's a mixture of both?
Well, we're not good. I think it's that onus falls on the attackers, right? They haven't even thought of it. A lot of attackers don't have the kind of infrastructure we have. They come from regions of the world that don't have power and gas lines everywhere. But as they think of it and discover more and understand how our own infrastructure works, then they'll start coming up with the attacks. And what's worried me just in the past, we're going on 16 months now, there have been two campaigns of malware that have been infiltrating the power grid and industrial control system networks, and they have been classifying them as reconnaissance. So they're checking out, counting endpoints and seeing what software revisions of various control system software there's out there. And that's always the first step before the attacks start. And we've had, frankly, only one serious attack on anybody's industrial control systems, and that occurred in Germany last summer, and it destroyed a steel foundry. So they are very, very serious when they happen, so we do have to worry about it.
Okay.
Yeah, I would just add to that real quick that, there's a Trend Micro report that came out earlier this year that was done in collaboration with Organization of American States, and they had, they did some polling, and they said like 53% of respondents have seen an increase in cyber attacks against critical infrastructure. There's some other facts here. 76% of the attacks were getting more, said attacks are getting more sophisticated. 44% of respondents said that the attackers tried to delete or destroy data. And 40% had attempted to shut down their networks altogether. So there are attacks that are not always showing up in the press or necessarily bringing down the grid yet, but there are attacks that are happening.
Why don't we talk a little bit about these industrial control systems? I know, Richard, you wrote a book about SCADA. Why don't you explain what SCADA is, because only a few people are going to know.
Yeah, and I didn't write the book. I published a book. It's a children's book called SCADA and Me that is supposed to explain all about SCADA. But even after reading it, you go, but wait, what's SCADA? And it turns out that it's really hard to define because it's just kind of a catch-all term for anything used to control the software and the messaging that goes across the wires to control systems. And every single device on a manufacturing plant floor here in Michigan or in the power grid sends back, temperatures or just status, hey, I'm okay, I'm still running. And they use these protocols. And those protocols, just like the original internet protocols, were never designed to be secure. They're designed to run on private networks. And unfortunately, everybody's connecting all these SCADA systems to the internet, so they're exposed to everybody. And people scan the internet now and show you great maps. You can go to showdown.org and see these maps of all these vulnerable systems.
Pretty scary stuff, huh, Dan?
No, absolutely. I mean, it's pretty scary, and it's, just a couple more of those same points that from the same study I was talking about. 54% of operators of major, critical infrastructure said that attackers have tried to manipulate their equipment, and 44% of survey respondents said that attackers were trying to destroy data in their system. So, I mean, people are definitely trying to get in. They're trying to get access any way they can, and no one knows that better than Richard because he's, like I said, written the book on it. But, certainly I know that the governments are, like in Michigan here, you can read the cyber disruption response strategy they have. I know they're updating it. The governor's working on that at a national level as well. But, how do you respond? Are you ready when an attack happens is another big issue. And, are you prepared?
Let's get to that. Now, government, that's something you can certainly speak to, having been at the state of Michigan, 13, 14 years?
Actually, 17 total.
Wow.
So yeah, but in the security space specifically, around 14 years. Yep.
And I know you guys were getting what tens of thousands of attacks every day on the state of Michigan, right?
Absolutely. Well, it depends on what all you count. You know, do you count different types of whether it be spam or whether you just count denial of service attacks or different type of attacks, but the numbers they're using in the hundreds of thousands a day, literally, of people trying to get unauthorized access. So yeah, it's happening all the time.
What can we do about that? Either of you weigh in here. What can industry, what can government do to make sure it's more secure and keep the bad guys out?
Well, if they can count them, as the state of Michigan does, they're doing something now. So that's a good sign that they can measure these attempts to get unauthorized access. That means they're probably stopping them, right? Because otherwise they'd be telling us how many times people got unauthorized access,
yep,
which luckily is a much smaller number. So government, got on the internet as a way of broadcasting to its citizens and constituents the information that they had, and attempts to move into this realm of digital governance, and we've all experienced it here in Michigan at the Department of Motor Vehicles. You get your tags online, all these great things. Now, last time I went in, I would text a message to a phone line. It would give me a number, tell me what number in line I was. I could go and have coffee instead of sitting in the office. So they're adapting technology. But unfortunately, they're coming to it late, right? It's not like the heyday of the late 1990s when a lot of us in this room were, getting online and starting to get engaged in e-commerce. And we all learned our lessons from 2000 to 2003 from spyware, adware, cyber criminals trying to steal our credentials. And a lot of industries, businesses have built up the right defenses. And government is way behind the curve, right? And at this point, they have to say, well, we need more money. And then that, of course, there isn't a lot of extra budget set aside for that. So I think what's got to happen is on some projects, they have to step back and say, look, we're not going to deploy new IT projects until there's a plan in place to make it secure as well. And then we can worry about going back and fixing all the other things we've built.
Dan?
Yeah, no, I think Richard nailed it. I mean, I think, just from a business perspective, people need to start thinking of a risk management approach. What is the most valuable data I have? Is it backed up? Is it encrypted? How do we protect it? What are the steps we take around that? Make sure that staff is aware. Good training, I think, is a big piece of it for end users. Help them understand that the policies and procedures around that sensitive data are very important and need to be enforced. People can start thinking about cyber insurance. I mean, I know Richard's view on cyber insurance is good or bad. I love to hear that. But, at least you get a checklist, and hopefully, if there is a breach, you get covered. But also working through the process of making sure that the right protections are in place are kind of part of that process. So making sure that, you have a response plan as well. So what do you do if there is an incident? What if you do, who are you going to call if there is a breach? Have contacts with law enforcement and others who can help you in that situation. But I'd love to hear what Richard's view on cyber insurance is.
Take it away, Richard.
Yeah, so we have to start with my view on those risk management things you talked about, in that I don't believe it's possible to do effective risk management because it involves knowing everything about your organization. And you mentioned knowing what your critical assets are. There are organizations that have been breached and the information stolen wasn't on their critical asset list. So the attackers have a better feel for what they want than you'll ever know. So ensuring is even more difficult to do. And unfortunately, all the insurance policies I've seen are written in such a way that the insurer always has a get-out-of-jail-free card. They can say,
yeah,
you weren't doing the right thing.
All right. Is it going to take Cyber 9/11 for everyone to get religion about this? Is it going to take some major catastrophe and all of a sudden everybody goes, oh, gosh, I guess we should have done that?
I hope not. I recently published a article that said, look at, if you're, head of a department in the federal government, think of yourself as that IT guy at Office of Personnel Management. Just visualize what steps you would take after the breach. And the country as a whole should visualize what they should do after Cyber 9/11 and the power is shut down for 4 months or something. And start doing those things now. And, we know exactly what's going to happen. Start doing what you have to do now so that we can avoid that disaster.
All right. We've got about 2 minutes left in the segment here. I didn't want to let this go by without asking you a question about hacked automobiles. There was a lot of that got a lot of publicity recently, and I just wanted to ask you what kind of risk that is and what the automakers are doing about it.
Yeah, cyber and moving vehicles is one of the worst scenarios possible, and airplanes even more so than cars, because we all, every time we drive, have to deal with a car randomly coming at us, which could happen with the cyber attacks. And it's part of the Internet of Vulnerable Things that you talked about, Matt. And cars, much like tanks and military airplanes and sensors, have been designed without the thought for what an attacker would do with that access. So, yeah, there's a lot of business for me and and for Dan in the future.
Oh, darn, right? So, Dan, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. I think Richard's right. I mean, Internet of Things is a huge area. I'm actually more worried about some other things like garage door openers. And certainly there are ways to hack cars today. I think it's going to be a growing threat. I've heard different people who would remain nameless say that, you know, in a couple of years, you know, it's even going to be more with autonomous vehicles, and that I think hacking cars is going to be around for a while, and it's going to be a challenge, ongoing challenge for the auto industry. Internet of Things, just making sure that if you buy almost anything, you know, a connected kitchen device, an appliance, more and more they're connected online, and making sure that, you know, you don't have those default passwords and, you know, the connectivity there. I really am concerned, especially about IoT, and I do think it's going to be a growing challenge, as Richard mentioned.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that on this segment. We've got to go to break, and we're going to come back with David Weaver, who's going to talk about all things angel investing.
Okay, and that segment went really quickly, Michael. It's amazing how much more quickly they go when we have people on who actually know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
This is the M-Squared TechCast.
Right?
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah, bye.
This is a previously recorded episode.
This is Mike Brennan.
And Matt Rausch.
And at the table here, we have a whole collection of folks that have one way or another dealt with angel investing. We're going to start off with David Weaver, who's the chairman of Great Lakes Angels. David, say hi.
Hi, everybody.
And then we carry over with Richard Steenan, who's a cybersecurity expert, but I just found out, taught angel investing where?
Not taught. I've sought
angel
investing.
Sought angel investing. Okay, me too.
So I'm a user.
A user. I like it. And we have Jason Vizzano, who is the CEO of Vectorform, a digital invention company, who has actually received angel investing, right?
Actually, from a typical VC. Okay. From a typical VC, yeah.
All right, great. Well, we're going to start off with David, because he runs the Great Lakes Angels. Let's start off with, what is Great Lakes Angels, David?
Hi. Great Lakes Angels is a group of collective accredited investors, which are wealthy individuals that have a net income of at least $250,000 a year, or $350,000 with spouse, or a net value of at least $1 million. Those are accredited investors that would do typical angel investing. Great Lakes Angels is the first group formed in the state in 2002, and subsequent, now there's a lot of groups scattered around the state.
And do you have a certain membership level? How many members in the group at this point? How many investors do you represent?
We, at our prime, before I left the state for a couple of years, we're about 25 to 30 active members in the group. We're in a reboot mode right now. We've got about 12 to 15 members, and expect to have hopefully at least 40 by this time next year, growing to 50. And we have a couple events coming up that are important for folks to know about. On October 15th, we have a whole-day seminar for accredited investors to learn about an overview of angel investing. What are the basic mechanics to become an angel investor? And then on the 29th of October, we actually have an angel investor meeting where probably five different companies will be pitching to raise capital from the attendees.
All right. And what are some of the characteristics you need to be a venture investor? I mean, obviously, you have to be at least somewhat wealthy. You have to be the old high net worth individual, right?
Right, so, yeah. High net worth. We just are asking people, if they want to join a group, whether it's ours or one of the other groups in the state, that you be prepared to invest I think most folks would believe at least $25,000 a year of your speculative money. This has got to be your play money, money you can afford to lose, because these companies don't all make it, just like VC companies don't.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is, by spending time with the companies early on and group intelligence from a group, you can have financial people, you can have IP attorneys in the group, operations people, all kinds of different backgrounds in a group that, when they look at the deal, bring a lot of different perspective to the Q&A, trying to learn more about what the company is, what the opportunities are, and where the deficits are, and how much it would take to make that company successful.
Now, back when I first met you in Great Lakes Angels, it was kind of getting off the ground. You met at an undisclosed location in Oakland County, where you had presentations from companies seeking funding and representatives of those companies.
Right.
So you'd have dinner, have three or four company pitches, and then people would contact that company if they had further interest. Is that still pretty much how it goes?
Yes. We've been partnering most recently with UHY, who's one of our early sponsor for this reboot, mm-hmm. and meeting in their office location over in 12 Mile in Orchard Lake, and having our meetings there when they're held. And it is by invitation only, just for the investors and the companies presenting.
Mm-hmm.
Mike was mentioning earlier to point out the difference between angel investing and VC funding, because I think there's still a lot of confusion. If you're a startup company and trying to raise some capital, most of the early founding of the company needs to come from yourself and family and friends, the three F's, as they say, and they add a fourth sometimes for fools.
And yes,
hopefully
right,
you have
sure.
no fools
in
there.
That's the common one, friends and fools that invest in that first round.
And so if you think you can draft up an executive summary or business plan and go pitch to the VCs and get some funding, that's very, very unusual, unless you have a track record and you're in Silicon Valley. That can happen from drawing on paper to getting funding. But here in the Midwest, it's most likely you're going to have to find some angels, whether it's a group or a former group or individuals themselves that help put some of their own personal money into the deal, which is different than VCs. VCs are professional investors that have a management team and have a lot of investment money from institutions into them, such as pension funds and so on. And the managers make the decision collectively on what company they're going to go into. And they typically don't want to make an investment less than $5 or $10 million, because their due diligence to do that is the same for doing a $20 million deal. So they're really looking for larger deals. So angel deals are normally anywhere from $250,000 to up to $2 million typically. And so that's not going to be attractive to VCs.
And
either.
It's typically very early in a company's formation, right? It may be just an idea at that point.
Yes. Most angel investings are pre-revenue. It's nice if there's some revenue, but the kind of revenues VCs would like to see is much later in the company. So angels are the place to go.
Okay.
So, Jason, what's been your experience with private equity finance?
Yeah, so Vectorform invents digital products and experiences. So we do that predominantly for the Fortune 500, but also we work with startups alike. So a lot of time is coming up with these great ideas, getting some traction, and then really finding ways to take it to the next level. So, you know, an angel is a great way to do that. You know, if you have a new company and you have some ideas or maybe even a prototype, an angel can really help you take that to the next level to get more users or an app potentially, or just some more awareness. You know, when you have traction, when you have revenue, when things are going well, you know, you want to raise more significant money. And that's when you bring in more traditional VC. And Vectorform has done that. And most recently, we formed a joint venture with DTE Energy on a company called Powerly. And that is a product where you can actually connect your home, your smart meter, directly to your app and show you how much energy your home is using. So this is a company that we knew we needed to go nationwide with and really deploy this technology. So that's why we sought venture funding.
All right, great. So let's talk a little bit about David. Now, you recruit from Ontario, from Ohio, and Michigan, right?
Yeah, when I founded the organization, I purposely called it Great Lakes Angels because I didn't want it to be just Southeast Michigan Angels. We look at the whole footprint of the state, including the UP, and I've was on the board for the Smart Zone up at Michigan Tech in Houghton Hancock. I've been there a few times. And,
it's a long drive, isn't it?
I flew.
Oh, well, good for you.
Had to go to Minnesota and then fly over.
Oh, my goodness.
But, yeah, we look from southern Ontario down, skim the borders of Indiana, Ohio for our deal flow. And we want angels and deals from that whole region to look at us for funding.
All right. So what are the criteria for a company? I mean, who should come to you? What's your sweet spot? What are you looking for?
The company really should have a good understanding of what the business opportunity is and how they're going to make money. And when they prepare a summary, they need to point out in that summary how the investor is going to exit. Angels and VCs have a very common way of looking at a business. They want to know how much it's going to cost to get into it, how much more money they're going to raise behind the round they're doing right now, so they understand the dilution impact and the timing on when they might exit, so they can determine what the multiple is on that, whether it's attracted to them or not. And a lot of companies pitch the technology and forget about how to get the investor out. We're not banks. We're not loaning you money to give you back your get our money back with interest. We are looking for 5 to 10x multiple on the investment in a certain period of time. That's roughly 5 to 7 years.
And the reason you are is because I would look at these same numbers. Out of 100 deals, maybe 4 or 5 actually do well. The rest of them, not so much, right?
Yeah, even getting through the screening process, you might see, you know, 30 to 50 companies and only maybe 5 of those get to actually present to the group. A lot of those companies could be in front of the group, but they're not well prepared yet. They need to spend more time getting their deal ready for actual presenting to a company. You don't want to make a bad first impression because that is the lasting one.
And is there a particular type of technology you guys are looking for, or a particular zero in on an area?
We've been very eclectic. We've done MEMS early on. Rick Schneider even came to our group one time to teach our folks about angel investing into microelectronics.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. And so we've done, you know, we do a fair amount of IT stuff. We've done some life sciences, manufacturing, all kinds of software. Very eclectic. We just want to see something solving a real problem that's more than just Michigan or North America. It's got to be a global problem with a nice niche where you have some barriers to entry and a good way to go.
Richard, you wanted to say something there. Go ahead.
Well, I was just thinking that my idea for a new furniture company probably wouldn't go over well.
Well, that's a good question, because some people think of some lifestyle businesses where they want to run the business and stay with it 10, 20 years and stuff like that would be something we want to invest in. Not typically. We
Unless
need to have a defined exit. And if you're looking for something that might be a furniture business, something like that, but it'd be a national franchise, that's a different deal. A one-off is not really going to be attractive because the multiple is not going to be there.
You are looking for scale, in other words, right?
Absolutely.
Fairly quickly. Yeah.
All right. Well, we just got the high sign from Jessica that we're going to have to wrap this segment. We're going to come back for the fourth segment, and we're going to talk about what's happening with the new Michigan Film and Digital Marketing Office. And Jason's going to weigh in and talk about video innovation, digital innovation.
All right. We'll be right back.
Is she on there now?
Yes.
Good question.
Still there?
Yeah, because...
Yeah.
Go ahead. This is Mike Brennan. Go ahead.
Meetups, you know.
Hi, Mike. It's Sean Hurwitz.
Some people come to
us. How you doing?
300 people.
Hey, Sean Hurwitz. It's Matt Roush. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be on. Thanks, Matt.
All right, no problem. Yeah, we're still waiting for someone to call in from the state film office, so you'll be joined by them. And plus, we have Jason Visano from Vectorform here in the studio.
Oh, cool.
Okay.
Yep.
All right, so we'll be talking about the end of the tax credits, or the credits for film and video and digital content creation, and we'll just see where it goes. I'm just going to ask...
Who's calling in from the film office?
Mike, you arranged that. I don't know who it is.
Where's my sheet?
It's Janelle Leonard.
Janelle, she there?
Oh, okay.
Can you hear me okay now?
Hi, Janelle, you're there. Cool. All right.
Hi there. Sorry about that. I think we got disconnected. How are you?
All right, no problem. It's Matt Roush.
And this is Mike.
Hi, Matt.
And this is Mike Brennan. And we have in the studio with us Jason Visano from Vectorform. And we have Sean on the line as well. We're going to be talking about what's happening with the film office now that the funding has run out and what's going forward. And I guess you guys are also sponsoring the Digital Summit Detroit here in a couple of weeks.
That is correct. You've got it all. I'm happy to talk about it.
Okay, great. We'll be coming out of break here shortly.
All right, sounds good.
So what song did you select this time?
Well, it's sort of like an 80s mix-up here, so I guess I went with Billy Joel.
Okay, all right.
This is a previously recorded episode.
There we go. We're back for the fourth segment. We're still getting this down. This is our first show, so bear with us as we kind of get all the procedure correct. This segment's going to be taking a look at what's going on right now with what's happening with the old film credit is no more, but now we have Janelle Leonard, the commissioner of the Michigan Film and Digital Media Office, who's with us, joining us from Lansing. We have in the studio Jason Vizzano, the CEO of Vector Forum Digital Invention?
Digital Invention Company, that's
Inventional
right.
Invention Company. And then, Matt, you have Sean?
Yeah, we have Sean Hurwitz. Sean, why don't you tell us a little bit about your company, Pixo Group?
Thanks, Matt. Yes, I'm Sean Hurwitz, the CEO of Pixo Group. We've been developing games and apps for the last 6 years. We started out in Michigan as a video game developer, became the first company in Michigan to be awarded the tax credit when it was a tax credit back in 2009. And now we build projects and products for global agencies around the world.
All right, Jason, tell us a little bit about your company, what you folks do.
Yeah, sure, Matt. So Vectorform invents digital products and experiences. So essentially we're outsourced innovation for the Fortune 500, Microsoft, Google, Intel, Walt Disney. So for us, it's about, you know, using digital technology to create the next best thing.
Okay. So I wanted to ask both of you, Sean and Jason, what effect has the end of those credits from the state had on your business?
Jason, you can go first.
Sure. You know, so unlike Pixo Group, we've never actually engaged in those monies, but I can say that we've definitely taken incentives from the MEDC, for instance. And I think they're great ways for municipalities to invest in a business, you know. And I think, you know, it's not something you definitely want to design your business around and rely on. And it's sort of a nice to have for you to maybe hire those few extra people to venture into new territory. For us, we ended up getting a discount on parking through the city of Royal Oak, along with the MEDC.
Yes, Royal Oak, where the municipal motto is "Welcome to Royal Oak." We hope you didn't bring a car.
Yeah, 80,000 in tickets last week at the Arts and Apples.
That's some money there.
Yep.
All right.
And Sean, could you tell us how it's sort of affected you?
Sure. Well, as Jason says, we never really built our business model around it. It was very helpful to get the company started and get the tax credit on some projects that we may or may not have gotten, and certainly wouldn't have brought them here to Michigan. So they were really helpful in the beginning. The last few years, it really helped us mitigate risk on some of the products that we were developing and trying out in the market. So we were able to develop a couple platforms, a health game that we were able to license out, and another engagement platform that we leveraged the incentive to do that. So it was very helpful for us. Now moving forward with, and Janelle will probably speak more to this, but what the Film and Digital Media Office is doing now is also going to be more helpful from the digital media side. So where folks like Jason and us can take advantage of it and get that support and that help going forward. So, you know, we don't look like it as certainly not a game changer, but we look forward to the new changes that the Film and Digital Office has made.
Sounds like you just got queued up, Janelle. Why don't you tell us what that is?
Yeah, well, thank you so much. I appreciate it, and I appreciate being on the show. Congratulations on your debut. It's been wonderful to be in communication with you. But as Sean mentioned, and we've been in great conversations about our efforts with the Film Office, and I just started this position in February, and since that time, I've really been reaching out to people like Sean, and I welcome the opportunity to speak with Jason about ways that we can build a sustainable economy, especially in light of the ever-changing credit into the incentive program, and you know, overall that program did end in July. But throughout this entire time since I started, I've been looking for ways that we can sustain the industry and how we can broaden our scope.
The film office has supported digital media projects in the past, to Sean's point, but we were always defined so narrowly by our name. We're not getting away from supporting film, but we need to broaden our scope to include other areas and see where Michigan is thriving in these in this industry, and digital media is definitely that. We see that with the high-tech, high-wage jobs in Detroit. We see a lot of startups and incubators in Grand Rapids as well. So from the film office point of view, we see it as for over 30 years we've been focused on building a sustainable industry with film, and now that we're at this crossroad, this economic crossroad of not having an incentive program anymore, what do we need to do post-incentive climate to sustain the creative industry as a whole? And that's where we have most recently unveiled the Film and Digital Media Office, so we can serve as a catalyst to support more than just film and much a larger scope of the creative industry.
Jason, did you want to weigh in on this?
Yeah, sure. You know, I agree. Michigan, you know, we have offices around the world. And, you know, our Detroit office has always been the office that finds a way to get things done. I think we have the strongest engineering and design talent really in the world. And I think, you know, whatever we can do to bring more industry to the area will be great.
All right. So what happens to the people that are looking to start up businesses, though? Because we you know did hear from you know from Sean that this was important to starting his business. Maybe not you know now that he's established, but it was important to starting. So how do we encourage more startups in this field?
Well, when Vectorform started,
go ahead, Janelle.
No, you're fine. I would say to Sean's point, like I mentioned with in a lot of our conversations, our role as a public sector is trying to serve as a catalyst to help ensure that the talent is coming, that we can help encourage people to come back to Michigan, to stay in Michigan. One conversation Sean and I had was, you know, we have a lot of great educational alliances that are training students in these areas, but are they prepared for the workforce? Can we? Is there a way we as a public sector can work with education institutions to bring them to that workforce opportunity? So that's a main initiative we're pushing as part of this, the media expansion.
There's a lot of companies, though, that were maybe more support, that were catering businesses, things like that. And because the film credits have gone away and there's no longer these big major films coming in, they are going away. Is there any way to come up with something to help them?
I think the hardest part was back to the previous comments about the sustainable economy. Because the credit started in 2009, it was unsustainable then with different levels, and then transitioned to an incentive, and there was a cap that was included. It was difficult for a lot of people to, per se, plan on having those resources, much less the diversity of a project, regardless of where they're going around the state. Are they utilizing those same caterers? So we are working right now as part of this transition to help train people that were part of the film and digital media, or part of the film industry, to encourage them to learn more about digital media as well and just broaden their scope also.
Is there some way you can work with caterers, Jason? I mean, is not really, or any of that support mechanism that was sort of slowly building in the state?
Yeah, well, you know, I could say this. We put our new office in the heart of downtown Royal Oak, and we're definitely very engaged in the local community. And we do say that our cafeteria is the entire downtown of Royal Oak, and we try to, you know, certainly support the community as we can. So, you know, I think it's a great thing.
I want to ask Jason and Sean both the same question. Do you have openings right now, and if so, for what skill sets, and what skill sets are you looking for?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we have openings across the board, certainly iOS and Android developers, certainly digital anthropologists and behavioral sciences, things of that nature, project managers, but it's a great time right now.
Digital anthropologist. There's a job title
I
hadn't heard of before.
Yeah. Well, if they're interested in applying, how do they do that?
Just go to vectorform.com/careers.
Okay, Sean, your turn.
Thanks. Yeah, we're looking for a business analyst. We are looking for a project manager as well, and a senior web engineer. And to apply, you could go to our website at pixogroup.com.
Okay, another question for both Sean and Jason is it hard to find the people that you need here in Michigan?
You know, we've had to get very creative with our recruiting abilities. So we've recently did a hackathon at the Dowie Museum down in Florida, you know, trying to find high venue areas where there aren't a lot of corporations to grab people. And, you know, it's been working so far. You just have to get very creative. But we've hired three people from California already this year on unlimited showers, no traffic, and be debt-free. So it's an incredible value proposition.
Are you going to teach them how to ski in the wintertime?
Yeah, bring them up here in July. Make sure you do that.
Time, yeah. Don't bring
them
in January. So.
Sean, how about you?
You know, as Jason said, there's a ton of great talent here in the state of Michigan. Some of the obstacles that we run into is, you know, are they experienced in a new field that we're in? So, you know, we're able to take the talent that's available and really train them. We've developed a training course essentially internally. And once we get them through that, they're ready to go. So, and it's another thing that I would say for the small business, as you mentioned earlier, getting in with some of the companies like Vectorform and Pixel will help them learn the industry firsthand. That might give them a leg up. So,
and Janelle, is there anything that we can still do for the film business, or is that pretty much behind us at this point?
No, absolutely. There are definitely things that we can do. The three pillars that we're really working through as we're crafting and further expanding our scope to include digital media, the three pillars are promotion, educational alliances, and partnerships. And this is exactly what falls into what Sean and Jason are talking about. First, we have to promote Michigan as being a hub for digital media, a hub for creativity. And we have the opportunity with the growth of the economy and the vibrant urban areas that we have. People want to find their identity here in Michigan. The new millennials have that opportunity. The educational alliances, to Sean and Jason's point of making sure that the students that we're training in the educational institutions, are they prepared for the workforce, and what kind of practical experience do they need to succeed? We see it as, you know, Michigan, during the next 5 years, we're expected to see employment growth in digital at 10.5% across the digital industry. That's huge over the next 5 years. And the average earning is $89,000. That's, you know, more than double of what the average income is, household income is for Michigan. So there's opportunity here, and that's what students want to see, is where can I make money? And then the third part is the partnerships, and that's where it's the public-private coming together. We as the public sector can serve as that catalyst, but engaging with people like Jason and Sean to know what your needs are so we can further elevate and promote it. So it's great pillars, and I look forward to working with you all.
All right. Well, we have reached the end of our hour. We've reached the end of our show. I want to thank our guests here today, Sean Hurwitz, Jason Vizzano, Janelle Leonard, David Weaver, and Richard Steen. And I also want to thank Jessica Rangel. Is that how I pronounce it?
That's correct.
Okay. She is our terrific broadcast engineer who was wrangling a couple of old, the rowdy tech guys here today. So thank you very much for that. And this is the very first M Squared TechCast has come to an end. So thank you for being part of history. I hope there were lots of you participating in that history. Mike, any final thoughts?
Yeah, it's been fun, and we're going to try to explore a lot of really great topics in the future, topics that, say, other people aren't recording or are talking about. We're going to try to go after those in business and technology and the government, you know, the stuff that Bridge Magazine is doing, we're going to try to do on the air. So if you got some ideas for us, we'd love to hear them, and maybe we'll get them on the air.
Yeah, and my email is mrausch@esd.org. That's mroush @esd.org. Mike, yours?
And I'm Brennan. Brennan at mitechnews.com, and this has been M Squared TechCast.
This is a previously recorded episode. This show is broadcasting live from Detroit Sound Studios above Activate Gaming and is part of the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.